Welcome to another episode of the Mindfield Podcast with your hosts, Kiri and Alexi. For those of you, who haven't joined us before, a big welcome and thank you for taking the time to listen. The aim of the podcast is very simple. We're here to try and open up conversations around mental health and try and have some fun along the way. We interview all sorts of guests, and they include the famous and the not so famous. Seasons 1 and 2 have seen us host professional sportsmen, psychiatrists, artists, entrepreneurs, musicians, as well as straightforward, everyday people. They all offer a unique take on what mental health is to them, how they've overcome their problems in the past, and how they've led happy and successful lives, even whilst battling their inner demons. They tell us how they have navigated their very own minefields. Today, we're delighted to welcome John Toms, a student wellness manager at Tile Yard Education, a record labeling college based in London. He's also started his own venture called Mental Wealth, where he's looking to make wellbeing and mental health workshops a norm in corporate settings. John, it's great to have you on. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. Yeah, it's good to be here this morning.
Good. And look, we want to rack your brains for sort of everything student wellness and student mental health, because it's something that comes up all the time, and we haven't yet had anyone specific who works in that space. So, but before we sort of get to that, I want to ask about your journey and so your backstory and how you got from sort of where you were younger, probably a student yourself, into a space where you wanted to help people and students specifically with mental health issues. Can you take us through it?
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for asking. Such a great question. I love it. I love what you guys are doing. Just thanks for being in this arena, as it were. That's what I like to call it, people stepping into the arena and having these conversations. And I love the name of your podcast, Mindfield. I think it's great.
It took us a long time. I can't tell you. You should see the backup list of names. There's some shockers. There's some absolute shock. I think one day we'll have an episode where we run through those, because there's some terrible creative sort of backbending going on to try and fit in mental health with the mind. But yeah, I know. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I love that. No, I think it's a brilliant name, Mindfield. It's brilliant. Good. So well done. Definitely vibing that. I guess for me, it started very much like having to look within and realizing, like, I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life with myself. Like, I need to like myself. I need to be okay with being present with myself. I need to be happy with who I am internally, externally. Like, I actually need to like this person that's with me every single day, which is myself. So I think it was that realization of, you cannot escape who you are and you cannot escape who you're not. Like, you need to actually address those things. I was one of 5 growing up. Obviously, you guys are brothers. We just had a brief chat previously, and we were saying about what it's like to be a middle child and to have other siblings. And I very much grew up feeling, I guess, less than, not enough, not necessarily needed. And that wasn't projection from my parents. I think it's just the reality of being a middle child. So shout out to the middle children there, me and Alexi, for one. Just grew up very underconfident. So I did not have a lot of confidence growing up at all. Like, very, very shy, very, very reserved, just did not want to show up, basically. So yeah, that was my backstory. So that led me onto a path of, okay, like, I get to either be a victim to this, to my circumstances, or I actually get to be powerful over this. So I think one of the main things I've learned is that we are all powerful over our mind. We're all powerful over our emotions. We're all powerful over choosing great decisions as we go into our adult years. That's kind of a bit of my backstory. Can you guys relate to that?
I can. You've put it in really, really simple terms. The first thing you said, I don't think we've ever had an introduction that's quite so to the point. And you're making it absolutely relevant, which is, you are going to live with yourself the rest of your life. You better get comfortable. And you know, straight away, all I could think was, I can tell that you spent some time talking to students with maybe, say, low self-esteem or confidence issues, because you're bang on. And I think we all know it. I think everyone goes through a stage in their life at some point where confidence is low, or you don't quite back yourself. And it's really, really difficult. And the way you've just put it there is perfect. I think I can relate. I think everyone can probably relate.
Yeah, it really does make a lot of sense. And I really like the way that you cut straight through to, you know, it is about that individual and that specific, because a lot of people talk about one particular thing that will really help you become who you need to be. But actually, just by focusing in on, you know, you and having that relationship with you is the most important thing. So yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And we've had a few guests on about the second thing you talked about there, the controlling your emotions, that you're in charge of your responses to things. And, you know, you're in charge of how you feel. You know, that's the one thing you can control. You can't control what people say to you, what people do to you, or even what happens out there in the world every day. But what you can control is how you respond to those. And again, you know, I think the Stoics and a lot of writers have written endless words on such a thing, on such things. But you've kind of, again, boiled it down to the really simple bit, which is, you know, fear, anger, sadness, you know, heartbreak, grief. These are emotions that we control, and listen, no one's saying you can go and control them straight away out the back and just deal with them as they come, but it's somewhere where we're all sort of trying to get to. We want to be emotional, we want to feel these things, but the ability to sort of control them and then adapt to them and say, well, actually, this is how I think I should feel to this is so strong. So again, thank you, because I think already you've sort of hit the nail on the head with a lot of the things that we talk about across the podcast. But I guess, you know, to follow that up, you know, you talked about being a middle child and the lack of confidence. Did that lack of confidence ever sort of progress into what you class now as a sort of mental health problem? I know they're all mental health problems, but, you know, to something a little bit more serious? Or did you always feel you'd got away with it when you now look back at some of the students that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis?
I think I was very blessed with my upbringing. So although I've shared that it was difficult in some settings, being middle child and lack of confidence, what it was is very safe, and what it was is very consistent. So I'm fortunate enough to stay with my parents together. Like, statistics are huge for kind of divorces, yeah, and parents separating, and that in itself is really, really kind of traumatic for children to go through, especially in their formative years. So I was really, really fortunate to grow up in a really stable household and with really loving parents. I mean, my dad could have told me I was off a bit more, he could have affirmed me a bit more, but he did a great job, and I kind of joke with him about that now. It's kind of a bit of a running joke, but I'm like, seriously, dad, affirm me, tell me I'm enough.
Well, he had five of you to worry about, so I have a bit of sympathy for dads and mums everywhere who have five kids to manage. You know, it's all bad enough when we're single and no kids looking after ourselves. Imagine having five others that you've got to affirm, yeah, every day.
Yeah, no, that's really real, and that's something really important to bring up, actually, because the important thing that we do in making powerful decisions about our healing journey is acknowledge that our parents were imperfect, but also really, really honor them for where they did do good. So I've done lots of public speaking where I've had to bring up this before, and I've had real like conflicts in my heart of like, how much do I share about my parents and how much do I not share? Because I never want to dishonor them. Yeah. But I also don't want to be in denial in the fact that there was lack and there was voids and there was things that they weren't able to give me. But I don't blame them for that. I don't hate them for that. Like, I've processed that kind of pain, and I actually really love my parents. But I also recognize where there was lack, and I get to share that with them now. So I'm kind of on that vulnerable, really vulnerable journey of having to be really honest about how I felt when I was a child and how I felt in my formative years with them. And it's terrifying, but it's bringing like a greater level of intimacy.
I was going to ask, did you first have to have that conversation with them before you went, mm-hmm, and shared and came to terms with it on a public basis? I imagine you, yeah, had to have probably a really refreshing and relieving chat with them when you first, yeah, sort of mentioned it. And what were their reactions?
So I think it's been really interesting. I think my dad's got a lot more tender over the years. So I think he's really, really realizing things about himself and things about his parenting. And he's had he's had five children. He's done amazing. But yeah, I think they were definitely receptive to the conversation. Yeah. And there's still more conversations I want to have, because I'm definitely terrified of having some of the conversations I probably need to have. But so far, so good. And I've enjoyed that level of uncomfortable intimacy with my parents, because I think the thing that we can often do is just write relationships off because of pain. And something I'm not afraid to face anymore is pain, in the sense of emotional pain. So I think often we will just write off our relationship with our parents because, yeah, it's too painful. They didn't give us what we needed or wanted, and they never will. But that's not actually true. I really believe in redemption. I believe in restoration. I believe in growth. I believe in, yeah, like hope. I believe relationships can always repair if we put the work in. So I'm very like hope filled for relationships to deepen that have maybe fallen, yeah, apart. And I think that has an impact on our mental health. I think one of the most powerful forces in the world is unconditional love. And the place we get that the most is from our parents, or from, yeah, people that are just really, really willing to choose in and love you.
Yeah.
So I think that can heal a multitude of mental health problems as well, to be honest.
I want to go back to one thing you said there, which I think was so relevant. And again, I've never really had this conversation, but I thought of it as soon as you said it. And it was about your dad going through a journey and becoming more tender over time. And I think one of the things we grow up with is always thinking that at one day, whether it's 18 or 25 or becoming an adult, we switch and we go, suddenly we've got everything in life worked out. Our emotions no longer change. We're in check. We know who we are. But actually, it's knowing that that journey never ends. And I now know it at the age of 28. I remember, then I look back and I think when I turned 18, yep, got this, all worked out. 25, yep, got this, all worked out. I know at 30, I'll think the same thing. And at 40, I'll look back and go, I didn't have a clue. I've changed again. And it's interesting you say that because our dad has done exactly the same thing. He's become more tender, realized things, you know, is more in check with his emotions. And it's something that we probably don't realize growing up. We just look at our parents and go, oh, well, he's got it all worked out. She's got it all worked out. There's no change there. And we look forward to having the same thing until we realize that actually, no, that's it's one long journey and we'll never, ever get to a point where we're stopped. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And we probably don't give them enough credit.
I think that's why it's so powerful that we're having these conversations right now, you know, at the age that we are. And a lot of the time I do struggle with thinking, you know, why are things still, you know, the numbers still bad for mental health, this, when everyone's talking about it. But we have to kind of acknowledge that there is a generational, you know, thing going on here. It's not that people can kind of switch straight away. But when you think about it, if we're talking about this, you know, way before we've had kids, then, you know, when we do have kids, we should be able to, just by having these conversations and listening into them, be able to understand what people are going through a little bit more. And as you said, you know, everyone can change. I think we often see our parents as very sort of stubborn and they're in set in their own ways. But as you said, John, like if you do the work, it will actually happen. And it doesn't have to be work as well. Like for us, I think it's like just having these conversations around our parents, and then they pick up on the odd one here and there. You don't have to shove it down their throats in any sort of way. And now it's just like, it's a normal thing in our family, just to talk about feelings, emotions, stuff that's going on. And it's a beautiful thing, but it takes time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's really important, to acknowledge that it doesn't have to feel like work. I think I try and keep it really fun. I try and keep it really light. I think even the term mental health has very intense connotations. I think when people see that phrase, they do think of like really, really intense, intense things. So I try and bring fun into it and joy into it. Like joy is an emotion that we can always access. So even when I'm going through my most painful times, I'm not like unable to access joy after that, or even during it. There's times where you can dip in and out of your pain and it's okay. Like just because you've tapped into something that's really painful in your heart, it doesn't mean you stay in pain for like 3 months straight. Like even last night, actually, I was on the phone with one of my friends, ended up really, really crying because I was being really vulnerable. I realized I was being really triggered about an event that's happening now that's happened to me in the past. And I was in absolute tears last night, but I've not woken up today feeling sad. I've woken up today feeling happy and joyful. It doesn't have to control me. Like I get to be powerful with my emotions. So that was last night and I'm processing that and I'm still processing it, but I can compartmentalize it while I do something fun. Yeah. So dipping in and out of the process is really important. And this is what I try and encourage my students to do, is kind of not become so immersed in their emotions and so overpowered by their emotions, but really realize that they are powerful over them. Yeah. And something I see a lot of is kind of like a lack of confidence or a lack of self-worth. And it's my favorite thing, to be honest, when someone admits that to me, because it's like, that's what I'm there for. That's what I'm paid to do. So when my students come into the first meeting, because I normally do like a little consultation with them, and when they open up, I just love it, because I'm just like, this, you're going to get free, you're going to grow, you're going to heal, like, because you're being vulnerable with me right now, I can work with you. And the reason I love to do this is because I've done it for myself. So I've seen what self-compassion can do, and I've seen what empathizing with people can do. And this is why I think it's really important that our generation really goes after this, because I think what we need more of is empathy and compassion, because as soon as you tap into that, you're able to really show that unconditional love that's needed in that moment. Because when you're vulnerable, you're literally exposing yourself to someone else. You're taking a risk that they're actually going to meet that need in that moment. And if they don't, it's super painful. So we need to be a generation that knows how to meet people's emotional needs. So for me, it's been really, really important to show compassion and empathy. So when I've got someone in front of me saying, hey, I have like no self-worth, I hate myself, I hate who I am, I hate everything about me, I have no confidence, I'm like, this is so exciting. Like, not because you hate yourself, but because next year you're not going to hate yourself, because we're going to work on this year, and we're going to work on your pain, and we're going to love you until you know that you're actually lovable. So I actually find this field really exciting, this minefield.
Yeah.
I actually find it really exciting because I have so much hope for it. I think we're in a very hopeless place when we look at it, when we look at the headlines and things, but I'm like, no, we are the most powerful force on this planet, like humans. We carry unconditional love, which is literally the antidote to the virus of mental health.
Yeah. Well, I think you found another play on words with minefield, which I have to admit, I've never thought about before. So thank you. We might have to tweak the intro for that.
Chuck that in there for free.
Well, no, it's brilliant. We've got creative guys working on this for months and they haven't come up with that. So well done.
Sponsor me with that, will you?
We'll just shift you some commission after this. I'm glad you brought it onto it, because I did want to get onto the student element and what you actually do for them. And already I couldn't help but thinking during that last 2 minute bit that, my goodness, wouldn't it be great if every university had a few people like you who could offer that service? Now, I think, you know, it's over a million students in the UK. It's big. You know, then you've got secondary schools and you've got everything that comes with it, colleges, higher education, everything. But all I could think during that was, wow, that would have been useful. You know, I'm lucky. I'm probably one of the lucky ones. Everyone suffers from that self-esteem issue, but I didn't have any serious problems at university, but I know a lot of people who did. And reaching out was a nightmare. And as you say, you know, the connotations that come with that word mental health, you're exactly right. People think of men in white coats or women in white coats and think of psychiatric wards and, you know, antidepressant pills. And actually, it's more than that. It's much more than that. It's much broader than that. And I appreciate you talking so candidly about it, because I think you're exactly right. We're onto something. And the empathy and compassion is the first step and will solve half the problems. Now, on that, do you want to just quickly, for context, sort of explain what you do at Tile Yard? I'm interested. I think you've given us an idea of what sort of a first consultation meeting looks like, but take us through your role.
Yeah, so it is a brilliant service they offer. It really is. I'm not saying that because it's me. I'm saying that because of the department. There's actually two of us in the department, and my colleague and line manager is incredible as well. Incredible. And she's an absolute ninja in the emotional health and mental health field. And she's just able to like get into people's hearts and really transform their lives. So I love working with her, and we're just a little duo that are there to really, really support our students, because it's not, and the thing with creatives is very much about what you do. So we are there to encourage them that they're not just human doings, they're human beings. Like, first and foremost, we get to be ourselves without just doing, because that's something I learned as well growing up. I am not feeling loved. I'm not feeling enough. So I'm going to perform for my dad until he loves me. So I'm like, Dad, look what I've done. Love me. So I learned at a young age to perform for love. And I think a lot of us can learn to seek approval from others. But actually, I believe that first and foremost, we are already loved. Like, so we were created to be loved. We were created to love one another. And I wake up every day knowing that I'm loved. So I don't need to work for people's love. I've completely forgotten where I was going with this now. I'll get there, though. Don't worry.
It's perfect time to stop and go back to that quote.
Okay.
That is so good. I've never heard it before said like that. But to move people from stop being not human doings but human beings, is that what you said?
Yes,
really, really like that, because I feel like we're all in this productivity war with ourselves and just as you said, just sort of doing for doing's sake, because I don't feel like I've kind of done enough of whatever it is today, so I'm just going to do that extra kind of couple more hours. And it's like this it's linked with the whole sort of attention that we have to have our attention on something all the time. And it's just the being part that we all struggle with, which is fascinating. It's such a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's an avoidance of pain. Like, I think none of us want to just sit there with ourselves, because we have to acknowledge ourselves if we sit there with ourselves. If we're busy, we don't have to acknowledge what's going on. So I think it's a corporate ignoring of pain, ignoring oneself, ignoring what's within. It's very easy to just busy yourself, and then you will never realize that you don't love yourself. You'll never realize that you actually hate yourself because you're too busy to realize that. So I make a habit, and I'm a massive extrovert, so this is so weird for me to do. And I was telling my students this yesterday in the wellness workshop, or Wednesday, sorry. But I just go and sit in my kitchen and just sit there and just look out the window, having a cup of tea, and I just have my breakfast for like 10 to 15 minutes. And it feels really, really abnormal to me to do that because I'm not with someone, I'm not doing something. But for me, I'm being present with myself in that moment. So I'm like, this is your time to connect with yourself in the morning, John, and check in with how you're doing. So daily check-ins are super important. I try and get my students to do this as well. It's like, I want you to check in and be present with yourself, because you can literally live such a disconnected life when you're busying yourself all the time and you're just doing, you just completely busy yourself, and you never actually end up checking in with yourself and being present with yourself. And that's what, when everyone was telling us to cancel 2020, it's like, no, I'm not canceling 2020. Like, 2020 isn't happening to me. Like, I'm in 2020 and I get to decide how my 2020 is going to go. I'm not canceling 2020. I want to be present for 2020. I know it's a global pandemic and this is awful, but I want to be present in 2020, regardless of what's going on around me. That to me is a very victim mindset, to just be like, cancel it. This is happening to me. It's like, oh, calm down. Like, we're still powerful over this. Like, yes, it's a global pandemic. Yes, terrible things are happening. I acknowledge that. And I acknowledge it's been hard, but we have to make powerful choices when bad things happen to us. So I think the busyness of doing covers up for how we actually feel about ourselves.
Yeah, no, 100%. So out of interest, and I know it's going to be different everywhere you go, but what are the most common things you see with your students, the issues that they face? I mean, I can probably guess, but I'd rather hear it from you. I mean, what do you tend to have to manage and deal with?
Imposter syndrome is a big one, actually. So this might be because it's a very creative university, but imposter syndrome. So yeah, having to show up basically, and then feeling like you're going to get found out for being a fraud. So especially if they're songwriting or singing, if they're vocalists or musicians, and they're having to put themselves out there when they're coming together with other creatives. So I think this does happen at uni because you're all in a shared goal. You're all trying to get to a similar destination, not the same destination, but a similar destination. So you're up against other egos. So pride gets in the way, ego gets in the way, insecurity gets in the way, and you're putting your kind of masked self out there because you're so nervous about actually putting your actual self out there. So I'm trying to constantly encourage them, look, you're enough, like, you got into this course because we believe that you're capable of doing this. So show up, be vulnerable, put your best self out there, and don't doubt that you're not meant to be here. So lots of imposter syndrome, like low self-worth, low self-confidence, and then a lot of anxiety and kind of panic attacks as well. And I think that's probably linked to being locked down again and the uncertainty. And I think especially in the music industry, the government haven't been super helpful in kind of the hinting at career changes, which has been pretty painful for people that have already been in this music industry for a long time and have laid their life down for it. So they're some of the things, but
okay, taking it back to the self-worth, because I think I want to focus up, rather than moving on, I want to focus on a couple of those, because I think it's really useful. And we get asked the question all the time, and haven't ever had someone in your position who's able to, I say, offer practical advice. And the first thing I say is, we know every case is different. You know, it's going to be very generic advice, but out of interest, what do you feel helps people with self-worth issues?
Well, there's things you can do in your head, which is going to get you to a certain space. So, and what I mean by that is kind of your thought processes and your kind of like negative thought processes you have about yourself, and positive thoughts and positive affirmations, and telling yourself you're enough. And I mean, something I do honestly is, look, anytime I look in the mirror, I make sure I say something nice over myself. It's not always out loud. But every time I look in the mirror, I try and make, again, this sounds really weird, I do all these weird like things, but they're powerful.
They work. So you can't work as well.
Like, nothing's too weird.
I really find that when it's actually what we need to tap into a lot more, because the weird is usually more ourself, or our more sort of like something that puts us out of our comfort zone, which again is like linked to growth. So
I'll know that if I ever see you in a restaurant toilet or a club toilet and you're facing the mirror talking to yourself, I'll know exactly what you're doing. It's like, I am great, and I'd love the idea of you doing that. I think it's brilliant, and again, it does work. It's
It just reminds yourself that when you're looking at your reflection, you're not speaking self-hatred over yourself, because it can be so easy, especially when you look in the mirror, to be like, oh, I'm not enough, like, I'm too this, I'm too that. So I just want to be happy with seeing that reflection, because that's me. So I want to be happy when I see that. I don't want to look at it and think, oh, I hate myself. So that was a bit of a tangent, but it's really, really just trying to, so a lot of it's in the head, basically. So there's things you can do in the head, but I really think a lot of the work that needs to be done is in people's hearts. So I do think, and this is why I really believe in counseling and really digging deep and processing the deeper emotions, which is what I was doing last night when I was triggered, is processing the deeper emotions and allowing myself to go to the depths of like my heart and find out what kind of things that have really hurt me. So like areas of pain. So I do think eventually you do have to dig deeper and go further back and work on your past relationships, i.e. your mum and dad. So the formative years, because a lot of what we learn and a lot of how we act in our adult years is because of the formative years. And it's so important that we go back and we find out why we think we're not enough, or why we think we'll never match up, or why we have low self-worth, or what it was that was spoken over us when we were 7 years old or 12 years old that we still believe right now. Because a lot of people's actions and dysfunctions now are because of things that happened to them like when they were like 12, and they think they're over it. They're absolutely not over it. Shoving it down is not getting over it. Like forgetting about it is not getting over it. Like if there's traumatic things that have happened, it's likely that they are still there and they will manifest at some point in your life and they'll probably blow up around everyone else. So I think a lot of deeper work has to be done as well.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And we see it all the time with adults. And I know one or two, won't mention names, who've had, you know, real health problems, both physical health problems and mental health problems. And they've gone and spoken to people, and they've sort of come to the conclusion and genuinely decided this must be it, that it's trauma that's happened in their life in the past, not physical trauma, mental trauma, that they've never processed. And we're taught this stiff upper lip, you know, is the way to go, and just bottle it up and just, you know, get over it. Get over it is something, you know, said to so many people everywhere, and you know, oh, just deal with it, or just go with it and process it later. People never do process it, and then it does manifest. You're absolutely right. And look, before, this is incredibly interesting on self-worth and confidence. The other bit I do want to touch on is anxiety, and I guess the first question on that is, we're obviously talking in the midst of another lockdown where I have to admit, I haven't really thought about students in it, but I think they've got it pretty bad. You know, students in general have had a pretty rough year. It's not really an education that you thought you would get, and it's very different. And then the second part is they're now at university and locked down, and yeah, it's bad enough for university anyway with all the stuff we have to deal with, but then doing it whilst also not having the support that you might necessarily need. Have you seen a big change in the last 6 months in terms of what your students are saying to you and the problems they're coming to you with?
So I do think since lockdown, anxiety has heightened. I think something that triggers the anxiety is the uncertainty of it all, because it's a fear response, isn't it, anxiety? So I think because there's so much uncertainty, and because there's so much change, and there's so much, I think even just change to routine has been really hard as well. Because when people do get into a routine, that's almost a coping mechanism for what could be going on below as well. And coping mechanisms are helpful sometimes. Like, it's not always good to stay in them long term, but they're there to help us cope with things like anxiety. So I think definitely, like, since lockdown, I think, and especially the second one, because I think it triggered everyone from the first one, because it was like, oh my days, like, we've been through this before.
Yeah, almost PTSD, like, you know, people know what it's like this time. There's no, the novelty of it first time round was quite fun for a lot of people. And it was, actually, I'm going to get back in touch with myself. I'm going to take my time.
Yeah.
There's no one looking at me. I can dress like I want. I can walk around my house in whatever I want at any time. Yeah. And I think now it's sort of dawned on people that, oh, I've got to do this all over again. It's not easy.
Absolutely. No, it's not. It's not. So I think people felt quite triggered in that response as well. So I think that trigger probably led on to feeling more anxious as well, to be honest, just because of that communication again of like, right, you can't go out and get your emotional needs met. You can't socialize, basically, which has been hard for students, especially. Sorry, go on, Alexi.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, do you also think that's because, you know, there are less distractions? This has come up a couple of times, but there are sort of less for people to do. And you know, is anxiety something that can come on in a good way to tell you what you're not happy about? Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think, to your first point, I think it's so, I mean, obviously the global pandemic's horrific, but I just wonder whether it's the best thing that's ever happened in a way, like the permission to stop and like step off of this ridiculous rat race, whoever's idea the 9 till 5 Monday to Friday was. It's not working. It never has worked. So
they're blaming the Romans, I think the Romans came out with it years ago. That's
the military.
Who knows, actually?
It sounds like something regimental like that and disconnected.
That's where school. That's where school came from, wasn't it? It started as army school, and then we haven't changed since the row of desks, and that way of sitting as still as we should. It's bizarre. If anyone and looked at it now from like a hadn't seen anything before, they'd be like, why are you lining these excitable kids up and making them sit in a
And also, why is it 5 days and not six and not four? If we came up with it now, there'd be all sorts of questions. But anyway, we could talk about school forever and ever. But on that, John, I guess my follow-up question was, do you think that everywhere, every university, almost every workplace, and I think I know where this is going with your answer, but do you think that every workplace, every school, every education institute should have a support network like yourself? And I know that you're obviously going to be slightly biased, but I can clearly see that you must be helping people. I know that if I was at university or at work and had problems, I'd want someone exactly like you, who I've never met before, to be able to help me through these problems. And do you think it's the future of how we solve these problems?
Yeah, 100%. In businesses, schools, everywhere, like literally everywhere, wherever people are, that kind of support needs to be available, because we haven't learned how to do it in our communities yet effectively. I think we're getting there, and I would encourage everyone, this isn't a lonely, isolated journey. So if you're on this journey, you need to be on the journey with your community. So tell your community that you're going through this. Like for me, I'm very much like involving my friends in this kind of process with myself. Like I very much get support from my friends. So I think we need to get better in our communities, but because we haven't yet, like I do think we need, wherever there's people, there's going to be pain, and wherever there's people, there's going to be lots and lots of issues that come up, because people, like, hurt people basically, and healed people. So I think we do need people that have done the work to go into these places and be a support system. And the feedback from the students that I work with, they absolutely love it. They absolutely love the service that we provide. And I think it is incredible to have that. So I absolutely think, because you'll often get, because we have the academic tutor, support team as well, so they support them academically, they'll go through their essays with them and things, which is amazing. So if we have that, then why not have the wellness as well?
But also, people have worked out that someone suffering from any mental health issue, whether it's self-worth, confidence, anxiety, depression, is never ever going to be performing as well as they should. We spend so long analysing their essays and their writings and what they're coming out with academically, and often ignore all the rest. And you said it spot on. Communities aren't yet ready to deal with all of this. And dare I say it, neither is probably the NHS. I don't think it's quite there yet. We're working it out. We'll throw money at it as a nation, as a world.
Yeah.
But we're not quite at the place where we can offer the sort of support that you can to your individual students. And I do think it's the future. For years we've had tutors who might help us academically, who are experts, but realistically, having a history professor as the mental health lead isn't right. And they'll be the first to admit that. It's just kind of let's cover our bases and give someone the responsibility. Whereas what it seems like Talia do and what you do is so much more than that. It's your focus. Yeah. Your one goal and what you're being judged on professionally is how many people can I help? How many people can I, sort out? But no, fair play to you, because I think it's so important, and dare I say it, probably the future. It often isn't a case of budget. A lot of these places have budget to throw at all sorts. When we were at uni, we had one of the library rooms become a puppy room. And don't get me wrong, it's great, and I see why they do it, but it was never a case of, there's no budget for this. It was just, where do we put that? And I think people like yourself are probably going to be the most effective way of reaching the most amount of people. So thank you for sharing all that. John, we like to finish off with sort of a few quickfire questions. The first thing that comes to mind, no pressure. A lot of people, they are often the hardest, and people take a lot longer to think of them.
So the worst at this.
No, it's all right. It's all right. It's not too bad. But the first one that we like to ask is sort of the greatest high of your life. When's the moment you look back and even maybe when you're looking in the mirror and say, you can do this, where are you? What do you look back on as being a real moment of realization in a positive way?
Oh, definitely, like my deep vulnerability. Like there was a, I can't go into it, but a moment where I was really, really vulnerable. It was totally worth it. It was painful, but worth it.
I have to be honest, that is the first time I've had, we've had something like that as an answer to this question. And actually, it's really refreshing because usually it's people saying the other side of it. It's saying, oh, it was when I realized this, but you are clearly quite self-aware to know that that was probably a moment that you look back on and go, without that, I wouldn't be where I am today. So thank you. There you go. it's a message to everyone, I think, who is who might be going through something like that. It's very, very relevant. Now, funnily enough, this question could probably be answered by exactly the same answer, but I've got to ask it. Your greatest low.
Yeah, probably that as well, because that was horrific.
Well, there you go. I think that is three seasons in, that's the first that we've had the same greatest high and the same greatest low. But you know what? I'll give you that. That can be your uniqueness.
This is easy.
I know. I'd like to say you're not going to be able to say the same answer now. I'm going to have to change the questions up. But I guess it would be your top tip to a student out there suffering with, I'm going to say anxiety issues because it's probably the most common thing we hear. So what would you say to them? And look, it doesn't need to be spot on. It's just something generic.
I would just say, don't listen to shame. Like, shame will keep you hidden. Shame will keep you in the darkness. Shame will tell you you're not enough. Just reach out. Like, we all struggle with something. Like, I have my struggles. Like, just because I'm talking about this, it doesn't mean that I've made it. Like, I've by no means made it. Like, I've still got a lot of work to do, but I'm talking about it. I'm getting my needs met. So just talk about it. Just share it. Like, a problem shared is a problem halved. And that's so true. Like, as soon as you share it with someone else, you just feel a little sigh of relief. So please don't feel shame about it. It's okay. It's normal. But it's not who you are, so don't own it. You are not anxiety, you are just feeling anxiety.
Yeah, no, it's very, very good advice. On that, we haven't talked much about it, but I think again, you might be onto something just because of everything we've talked about here. But mental wealth, which is your sort of on the side venture that you're looking to do, I don't know how far down the line with it, but I guess I'd ask just quickly, sort of future plans with that. Do you intend on seeing how far it can go and taking it to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's something that's really vulnerable, actually. I've started it with a friend of mine. It was actually her idea and her vision, and I'm coming alongside it with her and her husband. So I'm kind of coming alongside a vision, and we both have big vision, but it's like, it's kind of hard. I've never done a startup before, so it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I've always worked in the corporate world, and now obviously more educational and wellness. So I'm suddenly like, okay, like, I've got all this stuff within, and now I need to put it on a screen or put it in person.
It's the hardest bit.
It's the hardest bit, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. You don't realize until you sit there and do it. Yeah.
Until you sit there and do it. So, but that's also been great because we've had to really, really hash out communication and like work out what it looks like. And we're only a couple of months in, to be honest. So it's still very much the ideas basis. But yeah, I mean, my passion is basically what you were saying earlier. Like, I just think we need more people out there that have done a bit of work and that are willing to help others do a bit of work. And that's what myself and my business partner have done. So it's like, we just want to go out there and tell the world they're enough and tell the world that they're capable and tell the world that if they become a great person, they can do great things. Because that thing about, we're not human doings, we're human beings. On the flip side, if we become great people, we will do great things. And that's where I'm at in my life now. I'm like, I've spent 31 years of my life healing up, trying to become who I am. And now I'm kind of ready to do great things. So I totally believe in doing great things, but we've got it the wrong way around. We're slaving away, not feeling enough. And trying to do good things, where it's like, no, you're enough, and that's why you can do great things.
Brilliant. No, you've managed to turn a question about a startup and a new venture onto something that's again a very quotable thing. So,
and the worst for quick fire, I'm such a talker.
No, this is going to be quicker.
Supposed to be one word answers.
No, absolutely not. I think if we boil down mental health to one word answers, we'll be back where we started. So, honestly, do not worry. My final one, and again, you've given us a lot of these, so I'm conscious. I will allow you to repeat something you've already said because you've said so much, so much good. Especially, but a quote that you live by or a quote that you tell people and you stand by.
Interesting.
I mean, we're not human doings, we're human beings. It's perfect, but I want a new one.
Yeah, it's either from Brené Brown. I love Brené Brown, like Queen of Vulnerability, or the Bible. Like, my faith's big to me. So yeah, she's awesome. So either Brené Brown or the Bible, but I can't think of a specific one.
No, that's fine.
You've got to be able to come up with one from the Bible, surely.
I don't know, that's terrible, isn't it? Worst ever. put me on the spot then.
No, no, you got plenty of time.
No,
no rush.
I wouldn't have any.
I wouldn't have any.
I love quotes. I've got loads that come across me in life, but I can't think of one.
I have a really awful memory as well in general. There's some things that I remember when I start talking and processing, and then other things I literally couldn't tell you what happened last week. But yeah, it would just be something around like knowing who I am, basically, like knowing what my identity is, knowing who I am. Like, I mean, it's probably just the symbol I am enough. Like, I tell myself and my friends that a lot. So that probably actually is it. That's the quote, guys. I am enough. But find out why you're enough.
And are we saying, is that John Tom's 2020 is the source of that quote, or is that something someone else?
Yeah, John Tom's 2020.
I like it. Yeah. Good. We always like unique ones.
I'll take it.
John, thank you very, very much for joining us. All I'll say is that I think the country and the world would be a far better place, without sounding too cliched, if we had an army of you or people like you going around and helping people at work or in communities or in particularly in education and schools and universities. So thank you for what you do. I know it's a job, but it's a job that probably gives you far more worth than what most people do. And I know you're out there helping an awful amount of people. So thank you for sharing all the advice and just thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And thanks to you guys. Like, I really appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate your podcast. I appreciate that you're both brothers as well. I think that's a really interesting dynamic.
Just see the arguments behind the scenes, John.
A bit of kicks right off.
Yeah, we're wondering when to bring them on to the podcast.
Yeah.
You should definitely. New level of vulnerability.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you creating this platform as well. So thanks for just
It's so that people like you can share those stories. So thank you.
Brilliant. Awesome.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Mindfield Pod. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and get in touch. We all have our own minefields, and we hope that this podcast goes some way to helping you navigate yours.